My brief bio of myself is that I'm Jay Bernhardt. I'm a professor and chair of health education and behavior at the University of Florida, where I also direct a new center called the Center for Digital Health and Wellness. I want to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Stuart Usdan, sitting in the front row here. Raise your hands, too. And Monica Webb, one of our doctoral students who helped out with this presentation. The title, mHealth for Measuring and Controlling Substance Use, it's a bit misleading because I'm not going to give you a broad overview of the role of mHealth in substance use and abuse. What I'm going to share with you, though, in the middle of the talk is some data from some research that I conducted in my previous work when I was faculty at Emory University. So the data are a little dated, but I think that they're going to show you some interesting trends that are relevant for today. But also, for the last 5 years before Florida, where I just started this past summer, I was the director of the National Center for Health Marketing at the CDC. So a lot of the, some of the data you heard at the beginning from Kurt and we've discussed already is work that I had been working on. Again, no relationships to disclose relative to this. One of the things that's sort of great but also sad for us is that there are people interested in mHealth. There's a tremendous mHealth summit featuring people like Anish Chopra and Julio Frank and Bill Gates and Ted Turner and others who are really talking about the importance and the incredible power of mHealth in the U.S. and especially around the world, but unfortunately we've all missed it because it was yesterday, today, and tomorrow in Washington, D.C. So for very unfortunate reasons, NIH scheduled the mHealth Summit during the middle of APHA this year. Hopefully next year there won't be an overlap, but encourage all of you to go online, Google or Bing mHealth Summit and find their website. They're going to be, they've captured and will stream many of the talks from that. And if you've been reading the Twitter stream at the hashtag MHS10, you'll see just the excitement and amazing data that are being shared there, and encourage you all to look at that as well. mHealth, mobile health, you probably, if you didn't know a definition or have one, you've already gleaned one by now in the talk. Very simply put, many people are much more familiar with the term e-health and the use of electronic communication and information systems to share information around health. mHealth is, in essence, taking a lot of what we do and can do on e-health and applying it using mobile phones and mobile devices and other types of mobile portable tools and devices that allow us to share and exchange those data. It will and does allow us to do many of the things we can do in e-health, but it goes well above and beyond that because of the mobility, the transferability, the wireless nature of the of mobile devices and cell phones has enormous potential. You can see some of the types of devices we're talking about, different types of connectivity. When we talk about mHealth, we're not only talking about a traditional cell phone or a smartphone or a PDA. We also are talking about data transmission using other types of channels like Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, and WiMAX. And you could see some of the other things. We've heard today about some consumer-based outreach, as what CDC has done. We've also heard about healthcare worker engagement through SMS Medic. And I think that there's lots of in-betweens even of tools that can and do bridge those tools. One of the probably most important lessons we all know about mobile is it's far more than a phone. There are many other applications and uses of cell phones and mobile devices, many of which have been around from the very beginning of cell phones, including SMS, which has been around actually from the very beginning. The story of SMS is a great story I won't go into, but it's an amazing, it was actually created as part of when the telecom industry was creating the cellular phone network. They needed a way for the technicians to share data and information back and forth as they were developing it. It had never been intended as a communication tool, and certainly had never been intended as one that they could charge $20 per month per person in the country as a communication tool. So it's actually really an enormous high-cost, valuable communication tool. You see many of the other things that mobile can do. I want to share with you, when people talk about why mobile relative to internet, you know, there's still an enormous emphasis on using internet and computer-based internet for health and for e-health, and that's very important. We all agree that that's very important, and no one is suggesting that we not focus on that. But internet use has continued to grow. It's grown among all different ages, although it still is lags behind for seniors. But it's fairly high. But in the U.S., even at these top levels here, you'll see it's nowhere near full penetration. And the biggest predictor, of course, of lack of access, other than age, tends to be income, lower education populations still have lower access. This is not as true in other developed countries. The U.S. actually lags fairly far behind in home broadband access in particular. And broadband is really what matters when it comes to e-health applications, over the traditional internet or web. And you could see some more data here in terms of home broadband access in the U.S., only at 60%, which is surprisingly low, I think, in part because the price point hasn't really ever dropped as it has in many other countries. However, when you look at, compare that to cell phone access, just even in the U.S., we're looking at significant differences, far higher access to mobile and cell phone, and using, these are all current Pew data here, wireless internet use as well is considerably higher than home broadband use in many populations. Before I get into the to that, I want to share that reading some of the Twitter stream from the mHealth Summit, I may misquote these data, and I haven't checked the source on them, but if beyond the U.S., of course, when you think about why consider mobile versus broadband or web-based tools, just in the country of India alone, one of the statistics I saw was, and if somebody knows if this is wrong, someone could raise your hand, that it said that there are 80 million personal computers in India and 675 million cell phones in India today. So just think of those numbers again. 80 million computers, 675 million cell phones. So if you ask about what platform could we or should we be developing health applications for, I think it's a pretty much a no-brainer. And it really is a no-brainer in the US as well. So what I'm going to digress and share for a few minutes is some of the data from Project Hand. And this was a project that some colleagues and I did, funded by NIAAA a number of years ago, really at the forefront, at the very beginning of the whole area of mHealth and mobile devices in the health area. But what our concept was that there are, in the area of substance use and abuse and in many other health beliefs and behaviors, it's very hard to track behavior. So if you're going to intervene effectively on different health risks, you need to understand what people are doing. And beyond just in the case of alcohol use, how much they drink, which we often consider quantity frequency outcomes, but the context, where are people when they drink? What happens to them after they drank? With whom are they drinking? What did they spend the money on? You know, there's an infinite number of contextual factors that are important. And this, of course, is true for almost any major health behavior you might want to intervene on. And not understanding those contextual factors means that it makes it much more difficult to craft interventions that would be effective. So our research questions were trying to understand, can we use mobile wireless devices to collect these data, and not only the behavior itself, but contextual factors, also to compare them against gold standard measures, in this case for alcohol use, which is frequently the timeline follow back, which is a retrospective paper-based measure, so usually 2 weeks or 30-day calendar measure where you write about what you did and when during that period of time. And then also we wanted to pilot test this whole notion of what at the time had never been done before, which was a tailored text-based intervention. I'm not going to get very deep into the methods of this for lack of time, but we actually did multiple sequential studies with college students at a number of southeastern universities in the U.S. In all of these studies, they were moderate to heavy drinkers, so the only people who participated drank at least, I believe, on average about 3 drinks a week or more. And again, we used a number of different measures, including one I'll show you in a second on the actual wireless device, but we compared them to both the gold standard timeline followback, quantity frequency of alcohol use, as well as a daily paper-based measure, and a number of other scales. So this is what it looked like. We actually used a device that doesn't really exist anymore from a company that barely exists, Palm. We used Palm Trio. So has anybody ever have one of these? A couple hands of, remember your Palms? What was really amazing about these devices, these were really innovative touchscreen telephones and data tools. You know, back then we called them PDAs in essence, and these were wireless PDAs, but they really were the forerunners of the iPhone and smartphones of today. And in essence, what we did is we administered a daily survey on the wireless device using what at the time was a small piece of software, now would be called an app. This was pre-app, but in essence, we created and installed an app on the device, and each morning it would chime or beep at a time that you could program to remind you to take a survey about up to about 15 questions or 20 questions of your behavior from the previous day. So the morning after, you would answer, did you drink the previous day, and if so, it would ask you a series of questions about your drinking behavior. Reminders were sent through multiple channels, too. So we knew, because these data were immediately transmitted up to our database in the cloud, again, pre-cloud language, that would tell us if we didn't receive the data by a certain time, it would send an SMS reminder, it would send an alarm, you could get an email, and if at about 5 p.m. in the day you still hadn't filled out the survey, a research assistant would actually call you on the device and say, hey, don't forget to fill out your survey. So nonetheless, you know, because of this interactivity, we were able to get very high rates of compliance. First measures really just looked at feasibility. What we found on the mobile devices, we had a very high completion rate day. It's almost 86% compared to what was 97% on the paper, daily paper diaries. However, we did find out in post-test that for the daily paper diaries, many times people would skip a day and then go back later and fill out a day, which, because of course you can't prevent that on paper. So that, again, questioning some of the, you know, some of the reliability of those data if it's not done the next day. On the device, we would lock you out. You couldn't go back to any day but the previous data to describe your actual behavior. There were quite a bit of technological challenges. As you can imagine, when we were first doing this, the novelty and the innovation of it, that people did have some problems with devices because it wasn't as intuitive. The user interfaces weren't as simple as they are today. But we actually, people learned fairly quickly, and the problems, you know, declined very quickly in the project. Quite a few reminders were used. The reminders were, in fact, a big part of the data collection. And, you know, with a fair amount of qualitative data collected as well, people really did enjoy it and found it very easy to use, not disruptive to their day, and many people preferred using this versus paper and pencil. There's a paper just about this feasibility data I'll give you the reference for in a few moments. In terms of some of the statistical comparisons, looking at the mobile data collection versus timeline followback, again, we found I'll let you look at the data as I'm speaking, but in essence, overall, both methods attained fairly similar levels of reported alcohol consumption. There is some evidence to suggest that the daily data collected by the mobile device was probably more accurate. Of course, you can never know for sure, short of observation in the field at the same time, but because of the level of precision and descriptions of the activities, there were strong suggestions that the data were, in fact, more sensitive and accurate for what was being captured. But from a statistical point of view, they were comparable data, and that's perhaps most important from a treatment point of view if you think about comparing to the gold standard. Comparing to the daily diary, the paper diary, you could see up here the comparability across of these various measures with some of the interactive factors that played out here. Again, slight differences in self-report drinking days over the period, but not significant. So again, showing comparability between these two measures. The Taylor text message pilot was an interesting thing. Again, as far as we know, back when we did this, this had never been done before. What we did was we actually created messages, pre-written messages in a database, a library, based on the data we were collecting that would say, so for each day we would, for half of our pilot, people who had drank the day before and had a negative consequence. So if they say they had drank 5 drinks and then they were hungover, or they drank X drinks and then they missed a class, or they had X drinks and then were sick, or some other type of factor like that, they would get the following day, they would answer their questions about what their behavior was the previous day, and then later the same day they would get a text message, an SMS message, saying, you told us that you experienced this, here's some information that might help you not do that again, in essence. Again, very short messages. Because of the limits of text messages, they actually would get often 2 to 3 linked messages, so that, you know, but they would all come together so they could read them at one time. And you could see some of the measures we did, and what we found was pretty interesting. We found overall between the people who just filled out the survey itself at each day versus those doing the getting a tailored text message, that up here you could see the significant field, the most important one, was that drinking actually, self-reported drinking actually declined among the group getting the tailored message. So getting, and this was only a 2-week pilot, I might point out. So just the simple fact of getting a daily tailored text message describing problems you had experienced from drinking and giving you tips to reduce your risk and reduce your harm actually led to a decline in self-report drinking. And we feel that this is likely accurate because it also correlated it to significant and near significant differences in some of the self-reported consequences over the same period. So it's likely not just to be a social desirability bias describing that reduction. So just some simple implications from these pilot studies conducted a number of years ago but still relevant for today are the fact that we know mobile data collection is and can be less time consuming. Certainly leads to much more cost-efficient data analysis if you're not manually coding surveys and then checking for errors and everything. You have data in real time that can be used in real time or near real time based on the type of data you want to collect. Obviously gives you the ability to send and create personalized responses. Over a longer period of time, there is the likelihood of achieving cost effectiveness and cost efficiency in the sense that, you know, over a very short project like a trial or a study, it's likely, you know, the cost of papers, even with data entry, is often less than the devices. But as the devices become cheaper, as SMS and other tools become ubiquitous, it's likely that we're nearing the point of transference and cost issues. The areas of research are pretty obvious, the need for not only in alcohol to look for longer periods of time, looking at other ways and other tools, and we're at the point right now of actually beginning to propose and develop some of that research. There are quite a few papers in this space that we've described from this data. We'll make these slides available, and later today I'll also post these slides up on slideshare.net. So if anyone's interested in these slides, slideshare.net/JBernhardt. You can get copies of these slides later today. So just in before I conclude and we move to Q&A, I do want to say that, again, although these were conducted a few years ago, there has been quite a bit of research, an accelerating amount of research, I would say, in this space. I'm happy to say Kurt earlier referred to one of these papers, but there are a number of studies now looking at doing review analyses of people who've used SMS for either smoking prevention or other types of prevention, disease prevention, as well as disease self-management issues like diabetes and others, and showing that in essence, there is emerging evidence of the behavioral benefit of SMS interventions, very simple text-based interventions for health promotion and disease prevention. Again, positive short-term effects. We need longer-term and larger studies to really demonstrate that this could be a lasting impact. But the notion of lasting impact is possible because, again, these are so inexpensive and can be automated. These systems generally are automated over time, so they can be presumably lasting. The question would be, is there a fall-off after a period where people will get bored of it? You know, how will you keep people interested and fresh with it? So just before I wrap, I do want to say that there is a lot of exciting things happening in the mHealth space. We talked today about what I think is a very important channel a lot about, which is SMS and text, and I still strongly believe that that's incredibly important. Mobile web, Kurt alluded to as well, and I think mobile web, you know, the real craze, of course, everybody talks about apps. You know, there's an app for it, and it's exciting, and it's great for business models, and it's a terrific jobs program for computer developers right now across the U.S., and so we're happy about that, and they're exciting, but SMS has ubiquity and can reach almost everybody, and mobile web is soon thereafter. So for those of you who are entrepreneurs in the room, I encourage you to go develop apps. For those of you who are public health people in the room, I encourage you to look at SMS and mobile web as your primary channels for reaching the public. But there are some really cool tools. I just want to share with you a few key things. The West Wireless Institute in San Diego is doing some pretty wild stuff, including looking at pills that you could swallow that actually can record certain things in your GI tract as they're going through and send those data back to various monitoring systems. So for certain kinds of patients, following things. I mean, these exist. These are being tested today. These are not like science fiction for the future. West Wireless Institute also has, and I've seen demonstrated, a little, almost like a little Band-Aid that you can wear on your chest that actually monitors 7 or 9 different heart functions in real time, sends those data to your mobile phone that then can send them up to a clinic in real time. Real implication of something like that, of course, would be perhaps a cardiac patient, post-operative cardiac patient, to be able to get an early indicator of some sort of problem before to avoid rehospitalization, which could, in theory, save billions of dollars. iShU is a pretty neat tool developed that's being worked on now for seniors to help for fall prevention that would actually allow you would put it in your shoe or your sandal and it would measure your gait and send data back in real time to demonstrate where you may be having some problems by being less steady on your feet that could in fact then intervene with other people or with advice to help reduce falls among the elderly, a huge public health problem. Pretty neat tool. There's lots of apps, as I've already mentioned, including brain exercises and other tools that can be used as a health tool for seniors and others to help us keep our minds clear. There's a lot of very simple reminder tools. Trumpy is one. There's many, many others that you can go into, you sign up for, and you could get reminded for anything. want to be reminded to exercise, reminded to take your pills, reminded to call your mom, reminded to get cancer screenings, whatever your behavior might be. And they can, many of these are cross-platform, so they can do it by SMS, by IM, by email, by many other tools. You don't hear much about IM anymore, interesting enough. And then many, many others, MyNet Diary, and there's other cross-platform apps that will allow you to track and monitor and then intervene on different health behaviors. Again, these are just, I thought we shouldn't have an mHealth panel without at least giving you a taste of some of the other exciting things happening in the world of mHealth. And with that, I'll say thank you and invite my co-presenters to come up so we can take some questions. Thank you. And from a time point of view, it looks like we have at least 10 minutes left. So as they're taking seats up here, I don't think I could bring the mic over, so we might go to this last section without mic. So we'll just talk loud and ask you to talk loud, and please, any questions for any of us? Let's start in the back, and then we'll come forward. Yes, please.
Well, lower the better. I think what we're trying to say should be no more than eighth grade. Probably the slide is a little bit inconsistent. I think it's again, with the messaging, some lend itself to that better than the other, but the lower the better.
So in the front, yes?
That's a really good question. First, I should say that when it comes to privacy, at least in the arena that we operate in the developer world and healthcare systems over there, this discussion did not exist. You know, before they basically had records that keep paper records in a binder, and if that binder got lost, I mean, there's no sense of privacy there. And so, so that's my first point, I guess, with that. Adding a text messaging system where records can be stored in a database can now enable that conversation of privacy. And that it is a huge issue, and we're looking into a lot of things in terms of data encryption. The medical records system that I was showing you at the end that has user logins to increase the fidelity of that system as well. But it is a huge issue, but I think it's a good sign that people are talking about it now because before they didn't at all.
I'd say it is certainly a big issue in the U.S. as well. Many times SMS and Twitter and other tools are associated with what's often called the e-patient movement, era of empowered patients using technologies like this to share their own stories and share experiences. Social media are certainly playing a big role in that as well. When you talk about HIPAA and data security and privacy, it certainly does not, people are allowed to share what they want about themselves. There's no limit to you going on Facebook and describing in intimate detail if you want, any experiences you have. That's not within the realm of privacy. However, when we're talking about the ability to use these tools to link to EMRs, electronic medical records, or personal health records, when we talk about being able to carry your medical record in your phone, obviously we're going to need to reach a point of strong data encryption, the ability to transmit data in an encrypted and secure way. There are many of the biggest companies and smallest startups in the country working on those issues right now, in large part because of the significant investment from the Office of the National Coordinator on Health IT around electronic medical records in the U.S. So there are many people working on that. If any of you are looking to get into a business, not only the security side, but this notion of how will we use data and tools like this for patient engagement and patient empowerment, and patient education, which is part of meaningful use of electronic medical records, I think it's a great place for people to do a lot of investigation. Other questions?
Yeah, sure, I'd be happy to. It's a good question also. So I'd say in the majority of our field sites, the fastest record time for setting up a site has been under 2 weeks. Where we brought phones with us, we had dedicated partners that wanted to try the tools. They knew what they were getting themselves into. So they had done the necessary diligence and preparation on their end. So when we showed up with the cell phones, we just conducted the training sessions. Like I said, the training is very fast. Within, I'd say, a couple of days, you can really hone behavior such that there's good sort of scalability with the health workers, and they're actively doing their tasks with the cell phones. The way we've spread to date has mostly been by word of mouth. We have not really actively solicited clinics. I'd say it's partly because we're very limited by staff. We're a very small organization. We're very young, not quite 2 years old yet. And so we've spread, you know, very just sort of virally by word of mouth. But now we're at a stage where we're starting to reach out, approaching ministries of health to try and force bigger projects.
Can you briefly describe some of what you all did in Haiti? I think that would be an interesting.
Yeah, Haiti is something that I know you wanted me to talk about. We were very involved with the crisis response after the Haiti earthquake. There were more than a dozen partners involved, and we just played, you know, one small component of the role. But what happened after the earthquake struck, we helped set up a short code. So you know how if you watch like American Idol, you can text in like yes to 4584 to vote for this person. Similarly in Haiti, you could text in to 4636, that's the short code number, and say if you needed resources or if you needed help. So we had all sorts of texts coming in from all over the country saying, you know, we have 5 people wounded here, we need food in this area. And then we had an army of volunteers that were translating all these messages, and then we geotagged them. There's an organization called Ushahidi that helps to spatially map on Google Maps where texts are coming from. So in that way, we were able to allocate on a map where different resources should be going in Haiti. And that's primarily what we did there. So that's, you know, that wasn't necessarily under the purview of, you know, what we've been doing classically up until that point, where we just helped, you know, provide health workers with tools. This was very different. But the same technology was very applicable in that sense.
And how quickly was that deployed?
That was deployed, I would say, in a couple of days. Josh Nesbitt sent out a Twitter blast saying we need to set up a mobile communication pipeline in Haiti. There was a tremendous response from the mHealth community, and I would say within a week they had it up and running.
Yes?
After startup, how do you maintain the financial sustainability of the programs in each of the communities?
Is that for me? It's extremely difficult, I would say. It's been really hard to get money. I would say that once we were able to show results and publish the study from Malawi, showing that, you know, there's an actual impact, because there are so many startups in this space, and you really need to show, because resources are so scarce, you need to show that your system is more effective than other ones. And everyone's on the same team, but you're still competing for funds, unfortunately. We've had a lot of foundational support from the Clinton Global Initiative, from Microsoft, from Google at this point. A little bit from Gates, but it's been mostly foundational support and small grants. We have not had major funding to date.
But if anyone in the room is a potential funder, I encourage you to come speak.
We're happy to contact potential funders.
Do you have a follow?
I was just wondering if you've thought about having the communities contribute in some way.
Yeah, that's been a huge discussion, monetizing some components of what we do. And especially for bigger institutions, we've thought about maybe, you know, creating a subscription plan for the health records, for the electronic medical record system, where if they can afford to do it, they pay us like a monthly fee to operate that. And it's been a pretty intense debate internally, because obviously we're a nonprofit, and we want to be able to offer everything free of charge, and create as few barriers to entry as possible for clinics. At the same time, we recognize that some clinics do have the resources, and we should be sort of feeding that money back into the organization so we can better develop tools. Yeah, it's a good point.
Well, get the solution, would you pass that out?
I'd love to, yeah. Be happy to.
Are there other questions? Yes.
I have a question about the level for the provision of information in terms of providing health information. Which level? For example, like the government, national or regional or local government should, what level, which level should
To consumers, to the public?
To the public.
Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is, who is the most persuasive source or the most appropriate source of information? And I think the answer is, it's going to depend a lot on the community and the issue and the country, frankly. You know, in the US, the CDC has a great brand. It's very well recognized. It's very trusted, you know, source of information. So when that, which is, as Kurt mentioned earlier, when they started tagging their text messages with CDC colon at the beginning, I think that actually helped people realize that the message that was following after was something important and science-based, right, for example. But you know, for many other issues, local community, local government, for example, or a nonprofit might in fact be the most credible and appropriate source. And I would actually argue we all should be doing this, and that you know, in the notions of, if you think about what companies do today, so think of Coca-Cola, or think about Budweiser, or anybody, or think about Chrysler, you know, they're using concepts that are sometimes called 360-degree marketing. So they're trying to message you using all different channels at all different times. And so I would say that rather than, if we want to truly have an impact on health behavior and health outcomes, we really need to be messaging consumers using multiple channels simultaneously in perpetuity. So governments of, at all levels, organizations at all levels, because the competitors who are encouraging unhealthy behaviors are certainly doing that.
One of the interesting things, I really enjoyed the presentation that Vadim did. I'm also monitoring the feeds from mHealth
Summit.
and one of the lessons learned there is to build on things that have already been done. Mm-hmm. One of the things you described is exactly like what has been done in major industries for many, many years, called electronic data interchange, the inventory controls mechanism. And I wonder if you're redesigning something new, or have you looked at the way electronic data interchange has already been operating very effectively for many, many years?
I would say that I'm not extremely familiar with electronic data interchange. But I mean, to your point about replicating something that's worked in other fields, I'd say we're familiar with that. This technology, Frontline SMS, that we used initially, had never been employed in the healthcare field, but initially was used as an election monitoring tool. It's also been used as, you know, for community watch tools and things like this.
It's open source.
It's open source, right? It's open source, but no one had thought to really apply it to healthcare settings. And so we kind of took a page from, you know, seeing how it was used in those other industries and applied it in a medical situation. So I think, you know, the principle is there. And I would actually like to hear more about data interchange to see if that can teach us more lessons.
EDI, you should look at it, because it's widely used in every major industry.
We're just about out of time, so I'm gonna, we'll take one more question. Sure. As a former CDC person, I really can't answer what the future vision is for that, but what I would encourage you to do is to contact Kurt, contact CDC if you are interested in collaboration, or if you have ideas for collaboration, and they could better answer what opportunities might exist. I think from a research point of view that NIH, we all hope NIH creates more fundable opportunities, not only on the very clinical side of mHealth, I might point out, but also on the community and population and prevention side of mHealth. I certainly hope that that piece gets more than its little piece, as we often do in other types of health research. I hope that that piece of mHealth gets actually some attention. And with that, we're going to have to wrap. So thank you all so much for coming. Please join me in thanking our speakers. And thanks so much.